So I guess just to start off with, in this particular collection, you've worked really closely with the curators in the exhibition. So could you talk a bit about some of the choices behind the works you've selected?
Yeah, so Lisa Slade, who curated the first iteration of the exhibition at the Art Gallery of South Australia, is a very old friend and colleague, and she's sort of written and followed and supported my work for almost 20 years now. So I'm pretty hands-off when it comes to curating a show with my work in it. I think I really believe that other people, particularly if they're as good as Lisa Slade, I need to be able to trust them to tell a story in a probably possibly more refreshing way than I would with my own work. And there was exceptions. The Margaret Olley painting was one that I argued against. I just felt like I've seen that work so many times, and it really is a work outside of my broader body of work. It was sort of a homage to a friend, and in a sense doesn't fit into the themes that the rest of my work has been about, which are more autobiographical, I guess. So Lisa then just went to, well, she first of all convinced me that the Margaret Olley painting hadn't been seen in Adelaide or Brisbane, so it had to be in the show, so I gave in, and that was the end of it. And then she selected the rest of the show to tell the story, that to find the arcs, I guess, through my work that have been constant or newly appearing in work I'm making most recently.
Storytelling does play quite a large role in your works, and included in the mix of works in this particular collection is a self-portrait that you painted in 2012 after a lot of the experiences you faced in Afghanistan, where you worked as an official war artist for the ADF. Could you talk about how your experiences there have influenced the nature of your work in this particular collection?
Yeah, that particular painting, I had no idea, to be quite honest with you, how I was going to approach making a body of work about that experience, because the experience just seemed so much bigger than what my studio or my skills can afford, I guess. I don't know, it's hard. You become a bit overwhelmed, and that's possibly why I don't really do commissions. I try and find my own work. Find my own stories to tell, and obviously Afghanistan and the war memorial had expectations that I'd tell stories about that experience, but it was just so massive. And that self-portrait you talk about is really me having a break from worrying that I had no way of telling such a massive story, looking in the mirror and feeling a little bit haggard. And at the same time that was happening, I was making that painting right around the same point. The youngest man, young Daniel, who I met in Tarancot, who was 19 when I met him. He'd just come off patrol. His eyelashes had dust in them. He was fully armed. He was carrying the grenades for the small group of men he was with. He had a rifle, lots of ammunition on his belt. And he was 19, and I saw a kid. And I said, in front of all of these military guys, said to him, "Does your mother know what you're doing here?" Which is a weird thing to say in that context in that place, but the older soldiers who brought me to meet Daniel, I'd asked to meet the youngest man in that particular group, they all sort of laughed awkwardly, and I saw Daniel very distinctly get tears in his eyes instantly. And around the time I was making that self-portrait that's in the show, Daniel had actually attempted suicide. It was about 6 months after he'd returned from his deployment. And at that point, it was right then, around then, that I thought that I felt that I had a responsibility at that point. The War Memorial had paid me to go to Afghanistan and tell a story of what was happening. And the story for me became very personal about those friendships, the young men and women that I met, and how I felt. My gut instinct was that things were going to become very rapidly very, very difficult for them trying to return to the beautiful, peaceful community that we take for granted.
Since returning, you've also invited ex-servicemen and women to sit for you in your studio where you've painted them, but they've also shared a lot of their lived experiences throughout that process. So throughout painting those portraits, has the rapport that you developed in the studio influenced what happens on the canvas?
Yeah, definitely. I went from kind of over-analysing my role as a war artist overanalyzing, overconceptualizing how to tell that story, and really just took it down to really the Afghanistan show is the most important, straightforward show I've ever made, because it ended up just being about them coming, and they were looking to have, I think when you've returned from a place like that, and people, I was only there for a month, people asked me, what was it like? The first question they asked my family said, what was it like? And I realised instantly how impossible it was to describe that for me after a month, let alone for young Daniel Spain in 2RAR, who'd done two tours for 9 months in combat. And I was interested in the stories that I'd heard there were so immense, like nothing I'd heard, and none of the media in Australia were reporting any of those stories, because all of the members of the Australian Defence Force, many of them had signed basically a Defence Force confidentiality agreement, which is their protected identity status. They can't talk about their experiences in public. They couldn't talk about anything that happened over there. And I felt those stories needed to be shared, particularly for the mental health of the young men and women that I'd met there. So I just brought them to the studio and got them to model, and they're just straightforward paintings of people in front of me. And we'd often have a cup of tea or a coffee or often a beer and talk about how they felt, talking about their experiences, what they'd been through. And I then realised they lived in every town and every community, every suburb right around Sydney, and no one heard their stories. And it's also hard to get into asking questions about those stories unless you've been there, but I had been there, and they trusted me to not have to get through that first part of explaining what it was like, of just getting straight to the point of what is it like to be involved in someone's death, or how are you getting over losing one of your best friends in unbelievably violent way with a bullet in the head? Those sorts of questions that I asked and that I was able to ask then informed the paintings of the people sitting in front of me.
Your pieces are incredibly emotional and raw and have a great sense of authenticity to them. Given that many people believe that we're living in an age of anxiety at the moment, I'm curious to ask about what role emotion does play in a lot of your works.
Yeah, it's the most recent work. I mean, people can over-theorize it. I really feel like the most recent paintings in the show at the Archive of New South Wales are about my own anxiety, and I suffer with it, I deal with it. I think most of us do. And then more broadly, the works are about a collective anxiety, about the future that we face, in profoundly uncertain future at the moment. And then being a dad, having two little children, my dad taught me how to be incredibly optimistic, to think about physics and the endless of the universe. There are more pressing concerns for our instant wealth, our welfare, and how to teach that to children. So I guess the most recent paintings are probably the most personal about how I'm feeling.
The newest work in this show does include a giant 12-panel painting called Irin Irinji, and it is quite haunting, and the colour purple does particularly dominate. Could you talk about some of the colour choices within this particular work?
Yeah, Irin Irinji, Sally Scales, who's a Yanangu lady from Central Australia, the APY lands, and her mum and her, I asked them, would they let me make a work about frontier violence in their homeland? And Josephine, her mum, and Sal took me out to a spot called Irin Irinji. And really, I then responded to the story of that place, of a white man who was a very brutal dog scalper, killing dogs to get the reward from the government for clearing the land of dogs so that sheep could go through there in a particularly wet season, and it's desert, so the desert then encroached back, the wet dried up, and it hasn't been wet again since, and still the dogs have not returned to those areas because they were wiped out in 1910, 1913. In retaliation for letting his sheep and himself destroy waterholes as he went across the land, Aboriginal people killed him, and in retaliation for that death, many, many Aboriginal men were killed by surprise in a creek bed at that place near Nirringi. And really, for me, the colours are just an intuitive, visceral response to how I felt about that place, the great, unbelievable beauty of that place, but the sadness of the history of that frontier violence. And they're also obviously meant to respond to the place itself and what that place feels and looks like.
A connection to the land and the very visceral, real stories that they do hold do play a prominent role in your work. But I've also read that you've borrowed from psychological inkblot tests, which are also known as the Rorschach tests. I'm really curious to know how you first started integrating those tests as part of your aesthetic approach.
Yeah, the first time I made, my children call them squishies because you're really just squishing one painting onto another and all kids do it. I made a painting one day in the studio about 12 years ago, and it was a small, very, very thick impasto painting with oil on linen. And at the end of a long day, it was just a very bad, thick painting. And I had another stretcher exactly the same size of linen, and I literally squashed them together and pulled it apart. And I'd made two bad paintings. So that was not a great breakthrough. But at that point, I did see that there was so much possibility to use that thick impasto technique to sort of destroy the original image but make something, in a sense, more beautiful. The same reason a child loves making a Rorschach or squashy is because for the first time in your life, your hands can make something geometric, perfectly geometric, and it's all based on kind of glorifying the mistake of the original painting.
In the broadest sense, you've described your collection as a way that audiences might consider rethinking living in this world today. For those who are thinking about going and visiting your show at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, how would you ask them to engage with your works in this particular exhibition?
It's a very good question. I was asked that the other day in a live talk, and I said the only thing I can offer people is to tell them they're not allowed to touch the painting, sadly. But I don't know. It's a really impossible question for me. I'm too close to it to know how to guide people. That's really Lisa Slade, the curator's job. And I'd urge people, what I would say if you do go to the ACCO of New South Wales, read the wall text. They're written by Justin Pat, who's the international curator of art at the ACCO of New South Wales. And I think Justin's a genius. His writing for this iteration of the show made me want to go back to my studio and make more paintings. And I think that's a sign of a great curator and great piece of writing. And it's why the two are so intertwined, that constructive feedback and criticism and that word, that way into understanding a painting can be so beneficial to the experience of visiting an art museum.
Ben Quilty, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.